everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Psychology of Video Games podcast. My name is Jamie Madigan, and my mission in life is to popularize the application of psychology to creating and understanding video games. So whether you want to know about the psychology behind why good game design works, why people act and think as they do when they play games, or how those who market and sell games take advantage of psychological quirks, you'll find something interesting here. In addition to this podcast, I've got hundreds of articles, other podcasts, and lectures to share. You can find those at psychologyofgames.com. You can also find links there to follow me on various social media, subscribe to this podcast, and figure out how to support me on my Patreon campaign. This is the episode about habit-forming games. So, for better or worse, we've all formed habits, right? And when I say habit, I mean the kind of thing that we do automatically and without thinking about it at all. We brush our teeth at night. We make a pot of coffee in the morning. We murmur the same phrase every time we say goodnight to our significant other. We answer our personal phone one way and probably answer our work phone another way. We drive the same route to work or school every day. We pull out our phones and check email whenever we go more than 3 seconds without something else to do. Or maybe instead of email, it's Twitter or Facebook. Or maybe a mobile game. Just like everyone else recently, the habit-forming mobile game in question has been Pokemon Go for me. It's true, but I don't even think that Pokemon Go is a good game. It's actually a terrible game, game-wise. The act of catching Pokemon is tedious and requires little to no skill or practice. You just flick the screen until you catch the little critter. Battles for control of gyms consist mainly of spastic tapping, and that's even if you can find a gym that you think your little Pokemon has a shot of challenging. Most of the other gyms I've encountered just crush my stupid little Venomoth pretty much instantly. And even one of the core tenets of the whole Pokemon concept, the collection component, catching them all, this runs dry pretty quickly in Pokemon Go. I hardly ever find any new Pokemon to catch, and instead have to deal with flocks of Pidgeys that even Alfred Hitchcock would find excessive.
I hardly think a few birds are going to bring about the end of the world.
It's just not that fun or rewarding to play. But yet I do. Habitually. I play Pokemon Go and some other mobile games like it because habits are really powerful forces in our lives, partly because we think so little about them. Many products are designed to create habits for their users, and that includes most of the mobile and Facebook games that we hear about. These things buzz at us, send us notifications, give us information about daily rewards for logging in every day, and otherwise try to worm their way into the otherwise unoccupied bits of our lives so that we pick them up and play them without thinking about it. And it's not by accident. They're designed that way. Once you know how to look for it, you'll be surprised at how systematic and regular the triggers are to open these games up and play. Sometimes it's all about set times, like the first thing in the morning, or on a commute, or during your lunch break. But other times it has nothing to do with the clock, and it has more to do with what our internal states are. Boredom is a big one, but Pokemon Go is kind of unique in that the trigger to pull it out happens whenever we're out and about. Whenever you're passing by a location where you know a Pokestop or gym is going to be, Pokemon works because it creates habits, just like any other game, though. To get a better understanding of why and how, I talked this week with Nir Eyal, an expert on habit-forming products. In his recent book, Hooked, How to Build Habit-Forming Products, Nir presents the Hooked model to explain how habits form and how they can be broken. All this can easily be applied to understanding how games of any kind, but especially mobile games, are often designed to be habit-forming, even if you don't realize it. This is a really fun conversation that I had with Nir, as we talk about not just Pokemon Go, but Facebook versus Twitter.
This is why Facebook, by the way, is kicking Twitter's butt.
Why humans don't have fur.
One mystery that anthropologists have been thinking about for quite a while is, why are we hairless? Why are we the only primate that doesn't cover our bodies with hair? And it turns out the reason is...
addiction?
Addictions are never good. Now, in the vernacular, we say a game is addictive because what we really mean is that it's super engaging.
Snapchat?
In 24 hours, those other people's snaps will disappear. So you use loss aversion. So So for the ones who make great content, you really want to see what they're posting.
Monetization of games?
Because I see a lot of people trying to create habit-forming products that think that the only form of investment is money. And in fact, it should be the last form of investment.
And a few other unexpected things.
And to be honest, it was hurting our sex life.
That's coming up just in a moment. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the interview portion of the podcast again. My guest this episode is Nir Eyal, who is somewhat of an expert on habits. He's written a book and he blogs and he does consulting about habit-forming products and how to develop them. Nir, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much. Great to be here.
So who are you and what are you doing here?
So I've been working in the gaming and advertising space in my previous career. I started a company in that space back in 2008, back when apps were not mobile apps, but apps were Facebook apps. And so that company specialized in that arena. And at the intersection of these two industries of gaming and advertising, I learned a lot about the psychology behind behavioral design. And so when my last company was acquired, I had a lot of time to do some thinking and reflecting, and I really wanted to put down what I had learned, but also to explore some things I didn't know enough about, which was how do products change consumer habits? And I didn't really see a guidebook for that specific area of how to build habit-forming products. So I spent the next several years doing research. I taught a class at the Graduate School of Business at Stanford, and now I teach at the design school there. And then kind of what I'd learned in the class turned into this book that I published about a year and a half ago now called Hooked, How to Build Habit-Forming Products.
In that book, you talk about it, and it's a good book, by the way. I've read it and enjoyed it, and I'd recommend anybody, you know, go check it out. In that book, you talk about all different kinds of habits and different kinds of products that develop habits, including video games, casual games, apps like, Twitter and Facebook and Snapchat. And all that kind of stuff. And I think there's a lot of overlap with what you talk about and casual games, especially the kinds that you play on a mobile or a smartphone and on a web browser. And in fact, you do, you know, spend a good chunk of the book talking about how this applies to like Farmville and other games of that ilk. So Right. You have sort of the cornerstone of the book seems to be like this habit or hooked model, or which do you call it? The hook model, right?
Hook model, right?
Yeah. So you kind of got like four quadrants and there's like four steps that people go through. It's like there's a trigger, there's an action that the person, the user engages in. There's some sort of reward. It's usually like a random type of reward. And then the interesting sort of spin you put on it beyond, you know, behavioral psychology 101 is that there's some sort of investment, either of money or social capital. And then it circles back around the trigger. So can you kind of walk us through those four steps and the hook model in general?
Yeah. So you did a pretty good overview there. Thanks for reading and digesting
Sorry,
it. But
I stole your thunder.
No, that's perfect. That's perfect. We can end the podcast. Perfect. You got everything done. I think something that I would add to that is the importance of the trigger phase. So you got the four steps, the trigger, the action, the reward, and the investment. And you know, so big picture, 30,000 feet, what we see is that products will use these four steps designed into the experience of the product to form these habits. And so just to back up, what is a habit? A habit is a behavior done with little or no conscious thought. And so when products use these four steps, they're able to form these habits. They're able to have these behaviors in users' lives that we don't really think about, that we do. You know, something that's done with little or no conscious thought. And the ultimate goal of a habit-forming product is to create an association with what I call an internal trigger. So a lot of times people think of triggers, they think of calls to action, you know, play this video or push this button or whatever it might be, where the information tells you what to do inside the trigger. That's what's called an external trigger. Okay. But what I think product designers don't think about enough are these internal triggers. And the internal triggers, as I call them, these are negative emotions. These are things like boredom and fear and loneliness and fatigue and uncertainty.
Sounds great.
Right. Sounds awesome. But, you know, it sounds a little depressing, but the point is that our job as product designers is to, I think, alleviate human suffering. And, okay. And that sounds like a big lofty goal, but I really do believe it in my heart that that's the purpose of designing products, is to improve people's lives, to alleviate human suffering. And so the point is, why do I talk about these internal triggers, is because it's incredibly important to figure out what internal trigger you're addressing for the user so that you can build a product to properly scratch that itch. So, you know, a lot of what I see in terms of poor product design, or where products don't form habits, is not starting out with what is that internal trigger. Does it occur frequently in the user's life? And can we scratch that user's itch? So that's the first step, is figuring out your internal and external triggers. And then the action phase is all about the simplest behavior in anticipation of reward. The reward is scratching the user's itch, giving them what they came for. But then, of course, using this element of variability to leave them wanting more. And then finally, the investment phase, which is probably the most overlooked of the four steps. This is where the user puts something into the product, not money, typically not money. More often it's data, it's content, it's accruing followers, it's accruing a reputation, or acquiring skill. And these are things that make the product better with use. And the reason this is so important, I call this principle stored value, is that the more investment we put into something, the more we value that experience.
Ah.
And so that's what habit-forming products do. They get better and better and better with use because of this principle of stored value. They also, to finish the hook, they do what's called loading the next trigger. So every time I invest in the product, I put, you know, one of these things, data, content, followers, a reputation. Anytime I put something into the product, I'm also loading the next trigger, because it gives me it gives the company an excuse, a reason to reach out to me again in the future. So, hey, we saw you posted something to Pinterest, or you liked something on Facebook, or you tweeted something to Twitter. Because you did that, because you invested in the investment phase, now the company can reach out to you with a notification, an email, some kind of message to bring you back in the form of an external trigger that brings you through the hook once again.
Okay. So kind of walk me through each one of those four steps in terms of like a mobile game, you know, something like Pokemon Go or Clash of Clans, or
sure, yeah. Let's do Pokemon, because it's so everybody's talking Pokemon. Let's
yes,
analyze
they are.
It. Yeah, it's cool actually. There's a few different authors now that have read my book and seen the pattern in Pokemon Go, which is really cool. So
yeah, I've seen that.
Yeah, it's neat. It's neat to kind of see the model applied. And by the way, I just want to for people who really know psychology and really know consumer behavior, you know, I'm not. You know, every model is wrong. Some are more useful than others.
Okay.
And so the criticism that my model deserves is that it's not complete. It's not exhaustive. And the goal wasn't to be exhaustive. The goal was for the model to be practical, for it to be useful. And I had to leave out so much interesting research that just didn't make it into the model, because I don't think it's the most important stuff to focus on. So that being said, I think for the Pokemon experience, the internal trigger is boredom, right? Mm-hmm. This is something that humans feel all the time. There's a great study that I like to cite by Timothy Wilson that he did a few years ago at Harvard, where he took people, he put them in a room, he gave them only one thing in this room, which was a device to electrocute themselves.
I know this study, and I agree.
You know
it's
this
awesome.
Study?
Go ahead.
It's awesome. I think it's, and what he found was that about a third of the population, instead of just sitting there quietly, chose to shock themselves repeatedly.
Out of
because
boredom.
Out of boredom, because we are a species, we are a fidgety ape. We like stimulation, and we are psychologically uncomfortable with a state of doing nothing. Even meditation, if you think about it, is the practice of doing something by doing nothing. So we need to occupy our very fidgety ape brains. So boredom is a very palpable internal trigger. We feel it all the time. And what's happening, you know, demographically, is that people are actually working less. If you look at the hours, it doesn't feel like it, but it turns out that people have more leisure time. And this has been a trend for centuries now, since the Industrial Revolution. We have more leisure time. We spend less time foraging for food and more time doing other things. And so that means that we're bored more. So that's the internal trigger for Pokemon. The action is to just open the app. And then the variable reward is to figure out, where are these Pokemon, right? And so to get those Pokemon, we have to invest. We have to get out of our apartment. We have to go and go find these things. Then we have to go battle them. And every time I battle, I'm investing, right? By gotta get them all. That's the investment. The investment is keeping them, is acquiring them, is building this collection. And that takes effort. And of course, the more investment you put into it, the more work you put into the experience, the more valuable it becomes. You can't just quit, because what about all that effort you put into the experience? And right. Jesse Schell gave a great talk a few years ago where he talked about how in Mafia Wars there was a similar dynamic of, you know, I've played this game and now I've even started paying for this game. I've started paying for the virtual goods in the game. Mm-hmm. And because I paid for it, and I know that only an idiot would put money into something that isn't good, that isn't fun, and I know I'm not an idiot, therefore it must be good.
That old so, hobgoblin of consistency, wanting to our actions and our attitudes to be in sync, yeah.
Right, exactly. And of course, the more you do that in Pokemon, the more you invest, the more they have reasons to trigger you when there's another Pokemon that you need as you're walking about town. Those are the external triggers that bring you back through the hook once
yeah,
again.
It seems like Pokemon Go actually does a pretty poor job of the external triggers, because nothing will actually happen unless you have the app open. Like even if it's sitting in the background and running in the background, it won't buzz or give you notification if, like, oh, hey, there's another Pokemon nearby, or you just walked by a Pokestop. That's something I wonder if they're going to tweak or refine in the future. I'm not quite sure it's why. And it actually doesn't ever send you any external notifications at all. I got hot and heavy into it, and it's been a couple of days since I've actually opened the app, and it hasn't bothered me. I mean, it hasn't like sent me any notifications or anything.
It'd be interesting to see what they do with that.
Yeah, but the internal triggers definitely do seem to be there. And I think boredom, you're definitely right, is one of them. But one of the other ones that I think Pokemon Go has kind of nailed is socialization. Because it's sort of fun to go out and see other people who are obviously playing the game. And if you go like to a college campus, or a park, or, you know, other public places like that, you can see all kinds of people doing it. And my daughter and I, for a while, were going on like these 4-mile walks in the evenings, you know, together.
And it's awesome.
Yeah. It was fun to be able to spend time with her, and we'd, you know, look around, try to do some gym battles, and we'd look over there and see like another person with a cell phone and wonder if they were playing and if they were the jerk that had, you know, just beaten us in the gym nearby.
Yeah. And, you know, it's funny. I wonder if Pokemon Go is the first example of a mainstream fitness app disguised as a video game, because, I mean, that's amazing. 4-mile walk that people wouldn't have otherwise taken. And the same thing is happening here in San Francisco. I'm actually looking out my window and I can literally see people on the Embarcadero. And I know, because they hold their phones in a particular way that's not taking a picture. You know when someone's playing Pokemon Go.
Yep.
And it's amazing. Like, just walking all over the city, people are out. People are in groups, exploring their physical environment and also the virtual environment in the game.
Yeah. So as far as the action step goes, what are some of the important actions that game developers would want their users to take? I mean, obviously opening the app is probably chief among them. Is that pretty much it, or are there other types of actions?
Well, I think the idea is if the internal trigger is boredom, well, then the variable reward has to entertain. And so the action is just what's in that way, what's in the way of being entertained. And so it's the quickest thing that I can do to start scratching my itch. So in a game, it might be, how many steps do I have to take to be entertained? If there's a lot of friction, if there's a lot of steps I have to take to understand the game, to figure out what I need to do first, that's going to prevent me from being entertained. So when you think about great onboarding experiences, that's where this principle when I used to be in the gaming business, I would see this time and time again, that the first time someone would play, you had a very easy experience, right? Because you wanted to get the player up to speed on how the game works and what the key action is to try and educate them on what gameplay is all about. And then, of course, it gets progressively harder. But anything that keeps the user from that reward, from scratching their itch, that would be in that action phase.
So it sounds like the more successful games or apps are going to be the ones that just simply have the fewest number of steps between the trigger and the reward.
Right, right. That doesn't mean that they're necessarily easy, right? We need challenge. We need the game to put us in that state of flow, or else it's not going to be fun. Of course, we've got to balance how difficult it is with how easy it is, so to get that right balance. It's just that because once we are in that state of flow, that is entertaining. Now our boredom is gone, right? When we're in a state of flow, we're no longer bored. We've scratched that itch. So it's not about making the gameplay itself super easy, because that would make it boring if I wasn't in that state of flow. It's about how many steps do I have to take to get into that state of flow.
So it sounds like there's room for various different types of gaming experiences then. But it seems like mobile games, because they are, you know, they fit into the corners of our lives where we may have a few minutes at a time instead of, you know, an hour or two.
Yeah.
That might demand a sort of a different type of design.
Absolutely. And I think the what we've seen over the past few years, the reason that mobile games are so popular now is when you think about how many steps did I have to take to get relief from my boredom? Well, just the fact that the form factor is now a mobile phone, right? Mm-hmm. As opposed to, I used to have to go to my console at home after work. Now I can do it in these 5-minute increments, as you said, you know, waiting at the bus stop or between a meeting. Just the fact that the action is now so much easier, I can just take out my phone and open the app, that the ability curve has shifted way over, and now it's way easier for me to scratch that itch just because of physical availability.
Yeah, and another game I've been playing a lot of lately is Overwatch. It's the team-based first-person shooter from Blizzard. And to, like, get into that, there's a lot more steps. You know, I've got to launch the client. I've got to queue up and find a group. I've got to select a class. I've got to wait for a countdown timer to start before the match starts. So there's a little bit more barriers there, but what sort of, once you get in, like, you can just coast. You never, like, you just go from match to match to match. So it seems to move really quickly.
And I think there's probably a parallel there if you think about it. I get asked this question a lot of, like, look, you know, Ingress is the same exact game made by the same exact people as Pokemon Go. Why didn't Ingress go mainstream and Pokemon Go did? Well, if you think about what's the friction to starting to play Ingress versus what's the friction of playing Pokemon Go, it's not necessarily, you know, the design of the game. It's cognitive friction. How likely am I, as someone who's never heard of this weird Ingress thing, to start playing a game versus the cognitive fluency? I mean, we know this mere exposure effect, just the fact that I've seen Pokemon throughout my life thousands of times makes me more comfortable with it, right? I know that that brand is something I'm more, I have a greater liking to just because I've been exposed to it. So the cognitive load of doing that, of taking that action, of playing that game, is way lower, even though it's the same functioning game.
Yeah, that's an interesting take on it, because I've gotten that question a lot lately too. And people tend to want to try to pin it on nostalgia, which is maybe related. I mean, I was in graduate school when Pokemon came to the United States, so, like, it didn't hit me like nostalgia at all. But like you said, like, somebody says Pokemon, and I automatically know, like, oh, it's going to be a game about, like, collection, and it's going to be have all these cute little creatures, and I kind of know what it is. But something like Ingress, I gotta, like, well, tell me more.
And how's that work?
Yeah, I'm distracted. I'm on to the next thing. I'm going to go with something else.
And
Ingress, by the way, for the listeners, is the previous game by the company that made Pokemon Go, and it was similar in that it would use, like, geolocation or, like, GPS data, and you would go to locations and, like, I never played it, but I think you, like, tried to take over locations somehow.
Very similar to the gym
exactly
idea.
Okay, so let's talk about variable rewards, or rewards in general. And this is something that I get asked a lot about, and that is the variable or random nature of rewards that typically show up in video games. And in a lot of games, you don't just open a treasure chest and know what's in it. You open a treasure chest and you maybe get something awesome, maybe you get something just okay. And there's similar mechanics in play in mobile games and, you know, Pokemon Go. So why are variable rewards so effective relative to other types?
Well, because I think it comes down to the way we as human beings are wired. I mean, I constantly like to look to evolutionary psychology to figure out why we do the things we do. And I think when you think about what kept our species alive, I talk about in the book, I give this example of the Xhosa tribe in southern Africa that is still a hunter-gatherer tribe that lives the way human beings have lived for 200,000 years before farming, that is only about 10,000 years old. The way that we would hunt down animals, you know, many people think that we would throw spears at them, and that's actually not true. That what we found is that even though weapons are only about, I think, 50,000 years old, people have been eating meat for about 200,000 years. And it turns out the way we do that is by running down an animal. That still today, the Xhosa people will find a kudu, which is kind of like an antelope type animal. It's very big, has these huge horns. They'll find the one that has the biggest horns, the biggest, heaviest male, and they'll literally chase down this kudu. They'll separate him from the tribe, and they will run him down for about 8 hours. So they'll basically run a marathon.
So they'll literally just chase it around till it gets exhausted?
That's exactly right. And if you think about it, you know, one mystery that anthropologists have been thinking about for quite a while is, why are we hairless? Why are we the only primate that doesn't cover our bodies with hair? And it turns out the reason is that our advantage, our evolutionary trick that human beings have, is that as bipeds, without hair and with sweat glands, we can outrun any animal. Not in speed, but in persistence.
Hmm.
So if you want to kill your dog, go take him for a long run.
I don't, by the way.
But you know, dogs, perfect example, they have to pant to cool themselves off because they're covered with hair. Well, we're not. And so the reason we're not is so that we can do this persistence hunting that has kept us alive, kept us eating meat for 200,000 years, and is still practiced today. Now, that's a very, very long...
How are you going to bring this back to mobile games?
How am I going to bring this back? First, so I give that little story because I think it's fascinating. I love evolutionary biology and psychology. The way you bring that back is that we think to yourself, well, okay, physically, our bodies are able to do this behavior, to run after an animal for 8 hours, but what about psychologically? How does one maintain the focus to persevere, to run down a kudu? And so what we've been given, evolution has given us this brain that seeks variability, that tries to figure out what's going to happen next, right? And so that's what captures our attention. When that hunter is running after the kudu that is ducking behind bushes and over the prairies, that pursuit, that focus, that flow state is exactly what keeps us playing today. Hmm. It's all about variability. And this is what B.F. Skinner studied back in the 1950s, is all about how variable schedules of reinforcement keep people engaged. And it's everywhere. I mean, this is what, you know, variability is what keeps love and romance, what creates this drug-like effect when people fall in love. It's what makes movies worth watching, because there's uncertainty about how things are going to end up. It's what makes great literature. It's what makes sports interesting. It's all about variability.
And it seems from some of the other research that I've read, it's specifically about our failure to be able to predict something. You know,
right,
when we
right.
think something's going to happen and then something unexpected happens, we're kind of hardwired to be like, oh, hey. Wait, what happened? What was that?
Exactly. Exactly.
Why were we unable to predict what happened?
Exactly. And it's not just us, of course. Lots of animals have the same reaction. But if you think about what makes a bad movie, well, a bad movie is the one that you can predict exactly what's going to happen. It's a cliche, right? Or what makes for a boring novel, right? It's where something never doesn't, none of stuff happens. Or what makes, you know, people fall out of love with each other. It's when, you know, your partner becomes boring, not exciting anymore. They're not keeping you on your toes. All of these things are examples of what happens when rewards fail to be variable over time.
So can you think of any examples of games or products that relied on non-variable rewards and were successful in doing it? Or is that just sort of never work?
Well, I think it's the explanation for why we see so many failures in games eventually. Now, maybe failure is not the right word, because I think the natural life cycle of a game that doesn't have what I call infinite variability, the natural life cycles that we just stop playing. So think of Farmville, right? Farmville was the fastest growing game in history at the time. This was back in, 2008, 2009 timeframe. And then, of course, you know, Zynga was so successful, they used to be valued in the private markets at $10 billion. Now it's worth less than $1 billion, and apparently that's mostly real estate that makes the company worth as much as it does. It actually has a negative enterprise value. So
they probably have some pretty nice offices in San Francisco, don't they?
They do. They spent big. But anyway, so well, you know, what happened? Why did Zynga fall? Well, if you think about the history of Zynga, first game they had was you know, the first hit they had was Farmville. And then the next thing they did was to make the next Ville, right? It was Chefville and Frontierville and Farmville 2. And it was the same game again and again and again. And users started to figure out, wait a minute, this is just the same thing, right? Mm-hmm. There was not enough variability to keep users engaged. And by the way, if Pokemon doesn't insert some new variability, it will also become boring after a while because it's a finite variable reward.
I was going to say, in fact, I've already started to run into that because I've stopped finding new Pokemon. And in the areas that I normally go to, which is like home, work, the gym, you know, and the other sort of places we go for recreation, like it's just finding the same thing over and over again, and I'm not really filling things out. And I wonder, are they going to like cycle through like, okay, these are the trash Pokemon, you know, like we'll give you new trash Pokemon or we'll give you new uncommons that start showing up. So, yeah.
So my prediction is that they're going to, so there's three types of variable rewards as I define them in the book. I call them rewards of the tribe, rewards of the hunt, and rewards of the self. So rewards of the hunt are all about this got to get them all, right? It's going to get that thing, right? The around information, around material rewards. It's what keeps us coming to work, right? It's why a year-end bonus is a retention device, because there's uncertainty about what you might get if you stick around and work for your company. So that's what Pokemon is using today, is just rewards of the hunt. What I think they should do, and it'll be interesting to see what they do, is how can they use rewards of the tribe, which is a much longer lasting variable reward, right? When you think about experiences that are finite, you know, it's very difficult to have a finite experience like you would on a social network, because it uses information about your real friends, and your friends are doing all kinds of different things, right? When you think about what keeps us checking Facebook, you know, it's the fact that in your feed, you're going to see this interesting video your friend posted, or they went on vacation, or here's a picture of their pug. And so there's much more variability around what you might see.
I hate that stupid pug, by the way.
That stupid pug everybody posts. So I think Pokemon is gonna do that. I think they're going to integrate variable rewards of the tribe and of the self. Self is another type of variable reward that we're going to see more of in the future. And hopefully that will make the game more of an infinite variable reward as opposed to a finite variable reward.
Hmm. Okay. And it seems like like you said, those rewards show up in other non-gaming, strictly speaking, applications like Twitter, you know, and Snapchat and Facebook, where you log on and you're just like, what am I going to find? And is it going to be something really interesting, or is it going to be something not so interesting? And I guess that variability is what keeps us coming back.
Exactly. And I think this is why Facebook, by the way, is kicking Twitter's butt. Because if you think about what Twitter's model was originally, was the more people you followed, the worse your Twitter timeline got, right?
Yeah.
Because the nature of the Twitter timeline is that you see everything from the people you follow. Whereas Facebook never made that promise. That's not how the Facebook feed works. The Facebook feed is algorithmic. You see what Facebook wants you to see your friends posted. And so it actually gets better with you. So if you think about the investment phase, every time you like something, every time you watch a video, every time you comment on something on Facebook, they're going to show you more of what they think you're going to like. Whereas on Twitter, up until very recently, they just implemented this feature called what you missed, which is algorithmic, but everything else in your timeline is just crap that's not screened for, you know, it doesn't get better the more you use it.
Right. But I'm actually going to push back on you a little bit here. Let's go on a little diversion about the Facebook algorithm. I actually think it has the opposite effect, because the way it seems that the Facebook algorithm works is that it looks at things that you like or that you click through or that you react to, and it starts to serve up more content like that. So it's like, oh, I liked a video of that pug, or I liked a picture of my friend's kids, or I liked a picture of the vacation they took. And it seems to me like over time, my Facebook feed has got more homogenous. It's like it's like a little echo chamber of like, here's the things that Jamie likes, here's the things that he's into, and it doesn't really show me anything new, and it's starting to get kind of boring. Like I know the kinds of things that I'm going to see when I go to Facebook, especially because it is so aggravating in the way that it doesn't let you sort by default by most recent posts. And it'll show me the same things over and over again. It's like, well, this person linked to the same articles that I saw yesterday, or it seems like it, or talking about the same sorts of things. And so it actually reduces the number of like, oh, well, that's new and intriguing, or that's new and interesting. Where I can go
Wait, so where's the disagreement? You're saying exactly. Exactly. You don't like it because it's not variable.
Okay. So I'm sorry. I thought you meant that that's why Facebook had an advantage over Twitter.
I think Twitter is at the bottom. Facebook's newsfeed is better because it's more variable than the Twitter, you know, load of crap that you see in the Twitter timeline. The Facebook feed is better at getting that ratio. Okay. But I think it needs to get even better. I agree with you. I think that this is why they have hundreds, if not thousands, of people over at Facebook working on this exact problem, because the people who the more you use Facebook, after a while, because the algorithms still have a way to go, some people do say, I can't take this. It's not interesting to me anymore because it doesn't give the right mix. Now, I think they're working on that. I think the model is fundamentally sound. I don't know if the output is yet there because here you go. It's not variable enough for you. It's not showing you enough of the right type of content. But I think the system that they've developed is right in theory, but the practice hasn't caught up for everyone yet.
Right. Yeah, I'm thinking back on, I wish I could remember the link, but it was an article that some woman had written about when she was on Twitter and she started seeing things blow up about, I can't even remember which recent crisis it was. There's sort of so many to choose from, but like, let's say like a mass shooting, for example, like one of those that happened within the last few months, and Twitter was all talking about it. And then she went to Facebook and she didn't see anything about it because the algorithms had sort of determined that gruesome news is not a topic that she's interested in hearing about. So it just didn't present it to her. I think maybe it does sound like we're both on the same page, more or less.
Yeah. I think it's the variability problem that either, the right ratio between the mundane and the interesting is paramount.
So what about investment? That's the sort of the last piece of it. What do we typically talk about in terms of investment for mobile games and casual games? Like, what sorts of things are we investing?
Yeah, so I think with games, the investment is the work you're doing, right? The fact that you've gotten to the next level, the next achievement, the next accomplishment. If that game were to suddenly lose the memory of how far you've come in the game, you'd be really pissed, right? And you may not start playing again because you put all this work into it and now it's gone. Whereas when you put all this work into it because you've invested, you're going to come back. I was just speaking to a friend of mine who knew exactly how many levels he was on in Candy Crush, and he was very proud of that fact.
Right.
And of course, that investment he had put in the game is what keeps him coming back.
And you said earlier, though, that money is typically not seen or used as an investment in this way, even though I could have said, like, I've spent $100 on purple diamonds or whatever. Or lollipop hammers and Candy Crush or what have you.
Right. I think it's not the only, and it's not the most frequent.
Okay.
So per cycle through the hook, I'll do, the work of playing the game is something that occurs every single time, whereas maybe every, few times is something that I'll actually put money into the game. But money is a form of investment. It's just not the most frequently occurring. And I guess I like to de-emphasize it because I see a lot of people trying to create habit-forming products that think that the only form of investment is money, and in fact it should be the last form of investment, that I think that monetization is a result of engagement, not the other way around.
Yeah, that's probably a whole other topic we could get into, is like how are these things monetized and what's the psychology behind getting people to get engaged and turn that into either money or something you can sell, like data or eyeballs and advertising space and so forth. But
right.
Yeah, that's probably, maybe I'll invite you back on sometime to talk about that. One thing I've been kind of shocked by, the first time that I saw a game advertise itself as addictive, or habit forming. You know, be like, come play this new Facebook game or this new mobile game. It's the most addictive habit forming game ever. And that seems to be like a selling point. I mean, it was literally a selling point because it was a point they were using to sell the app and to advertise it. So do you think, let me throw a loaded question at you, an admittedly loaded question. Like, do you think that creating powerful habits in games like these is evil or any sort of misbehavior on the game maker's part?
So, it depends how we define the terms. So a habit is just an impulse to do a behavior with little or no conscious thought. And we have good habits as well as bad habits. As opposed to addiction. Addiction is a persistent compulsive dependency on a behavior or substance that harms the user. So addictions are never good. Now, in the vernacular, we say addiction, we say a game is addictive because what we really mean is that it's super engaging because, you know, we want things to be engaging. We want products to draw us in because that's the fundamental purpose they serve for us. That's how they alleviate our suffering, is that they entertain us. And of course, we wouldn't want it any other way, right? We don't want people to make shitty products. We want people to make fun, engaging products. So that's why they're advertising it in that way, even though it's not true to the definition of what addiction actually is. So when we think about the ethics of building habit-forming products and potentially addictive products, you know, I think that any product that is sufficiently good and used by a sufficiently large number of people will addict someone. Okay. That if you've ever seen the television show Intervention, which is a very interesting show, it's on YouTube. But basically, this is a show about how certain people get addicted to all sorts of things. So of course they have the usual suspects of alcohol and heroin and, you know, hard drugs. But then they also have the person who's addicted to sniffing gasoline, or the person who's addicted to eating paint, or the, you know, these very strange addictions that are not very common for everyday household items. And so, you know, it turns out that the science of addiction tells us that there are some people who have this psychographic profile, this predilection for addiction, right? And that's about 1%, 2% of the population that has that predilection. Now, for the vast majority of people, gameplay or using a habit-forming product is not a problem. And here's the test for whether it's a problem. The two-part test is, does it harm you? Yes or no. And can you stop? Yes or no. So if it...
Do you think the user is necessarily the best person to be answering those questions?
Well, I think that's one frame to start. I think there's three lenses. We can look at it from the user's perspective, we can look at it from the maker's perspective, and we can look at it from the person working at the maker's perspective, right? So we can take any one of those three lenses, but let's look, or we can even look at it the societal perspective. But let's take a look at it from the user's perspective first. So the user's perspective is, does it hurt you, and can you stop? And if you say to me, look, it does hurt me or it doesn't hurt me, but I can stop, then it's not an addiction. To me, that's maybe a habit. Maybe it's even a bad habit, but it's not an addiction. And for the vast majority of people, when you ask them, you know, okay, yes, I know Facebook is very good and you want to use it all the time, or yes, I know this game is very good and you want to play it all the time, but can you stop? And if they say, yeah, I can, well, then that's just a well-made product that engages you. And so I think that's where the personal responsibility side comes in. And it turns out the vast majority of people can stop playing or using these experiences, because as good as they are, you know, we're not freebasing Facebook, we're not injecting Instagram, right? It's not
yet.
yet, exactly. It's not that level of addiction. We have to put it in proportion. However, I think there are some people, that 1-2% of the population that is addicted, that has other issues going on that they need help. Where if you ask them, if you said, look, is this harming you? They would say yes. And if you said, can you stop? And they said no, then I think we have a very special responsibility. So this is the kind of person who you see in Las Vegas, right? This is the kind of person who is playing to an extent that it is harming them in their lives and they cannot stop. The thing is, though, and this is what I need your help on, Jamie, is that I want the industry to help with those folks, right? For everyone else, I think that's a personal responsibility issue. However, we have a very special opportunity, I think, in technology, because for the first time, we know who the addicts are. So if you think about,
we get data on them, don't we?
Exactly. Think about, you know, when it comes to other addictive products, right? Alcohol has been around for a very, very long time. The first thing that Noah does when he steps off the ark in the Bible is he plants a vineyard, gets drunk. Like, we know that people have been abusing.
Dude liked to party, yeah.
Right. So that's not new. What's new is, though, if you were an alcohol distributor, right, or an alcohol distiller, I should say, you to this day have no idea who the alcoholics are. You don't know who's abusing your product. But the game makers know, right? The game makers have personally identifiable information to know who's using their products, how much, and how. So I think if you know that someone is using your product to an extent that it may be harming their lives and they want to stop, then you have an ethical responsibility. And that's where I want companies like Snapchat and Facebook and Instagram and definitely the gaming companies to do something for that tiny percentage of users, the 1 to 2% who want to stop but are having difficulty stopping. And there's lots of things we can do, right? I want them to put in their terms of service, look, we love our players. We love our users. And if you're showing a pattern of using our product to the extent that it may be harming you, we're going to, number one, ask you if you'd like help moderating your use. And if you tell us yes, we're going to help you do that. Now, it's, again, a very small proportion of users, right. But I think that puts the industry in a very good ethical position to say, look, we're watching out for you. We're going to help you stop if you want to stop. Because, you know, particularly in the gaming industry, and this is that one industry one part of our industry that I don't know if can actually do something. When you think about the free-to-play gaming industry, they scare me a bit because some games, not all of them, some games are so reliant on the addicted users, on the users who are playing to an unhealthy extent that I don't know if they could stay in business without them. So that's what we would see happening. Like the companies that would say, no, we can't do that. Well, that tells you that they are themselves addicted to the addicts.
That's an interesting way of putting it. Yeah. I'm just picturing like Pikachu coming up on your phone and being like, hey man, you okay? I know you walked like 40 miles today, or maybe you should take a break. Stop trying to catch them all.
So there's an example already of a company that does this, Stack Overflow.
So you're right. They do. Yeah,
exactly. Stack Overflow. Jeff Atwood told me he wanted that game, that site to be something that enhances people's lives and doesn't become their life. So today on Stack Overflow, if you use Stack Overflow more than 20 hours a week, you can't accrue any more upvotes, any more points. Mm-hmm. Right? I think that's a great model. Like, give me some number. How many miles on Pokemon or how many hours on Facebook is probably unhealthy? And I'm not saying cut the user off. It's not raw paternalism where we just say, no, stop using it. I'm saying let's ask the user if they need help and then provide them a way to offboard, so to speak, to help them get their behavior under control. Yeah, so I think the first step is to recognize that this stuff doesn't happen by chance. That I think that what we face, not so much in the gaming industry. I think the gaming industry has known these techniques for quite a while. But when I think of all the other places we could use game-like mechanics, I think that the real tragedy that we need to face is not so much the few people who are addicted, like we talked about before. That's disheartening, and we need to do something for those folks. But the real tragedy is that far too much software out there is not engaging at all, right? It's just awful, right? When you think about what we have to do to interact with our local governments or with local businesses, I mean, it's really hard to use the technology that they want us to use. And so I think the first step is to bring greater awareness to these methodologies in the first place for all kinds of applications, right? It's not just about gamification. It's good design implements these techniques. So my focus is not so much the gaming industry as it is everybody else that you should use these same mechanics to make all sorts of experiences, things that people want to use as opposed to things that people have to use.
Okay. So what about if people want to not use them? So let's say that I am spending too much time on Twitter, or I am spending too much time playing Clash Royale or any other game. Like, what are some general tips that you could give somebody to break that habit or replace it with a habit that's more agreeable to them or what have you?
Yeah. So I think it's a terrific question, and it's a big reason why I wrote the book is that I think it's by understanding these hooks that we can put technology in its place, that we can break these unwanted habits. And so I've been using the hook model ever since I kind of developed it and started publishing it to break my own bad habits. And I'll be the first to admit that, you know, I struggle with technology all the time, particularly when I'm feeling stressed, when I'm looking for an escape. I will turn to these experiences, be it a game, be it the social network, be it email, to stop having to do things I don't want to do, you know, like, you know, working very hard on a essay that I'm not, you know, having a breakthrough around. I will use these things as escape. And so what we need to do is to figure out how to break those unwanted habits. And so what we do is we take out the hook model and we try and figure out, how do I remove the triggers? How do I make the actions more difficult? How do I delay the rewards? And how do we make sure not to invest in these experiences? So I'll give you a few examples. So one thing that we have a lot of in Silicon Valley, and I'm sure, you know, all over the world now, is that, you know, at nighttime, I was finding personally that instead of spending time with my wife and having a conversation after dinner, we were going straight to our devices, right? We were checking email, we were on Facebook, and we're doing whatever, as opposed to actually connecting as a couple. And to be honest, it was hurting our sex life. And okay. So what we decided to do was, I went to a hardware store and I bought a $5 outlet timer. Ah. And that outlet timer, you can program it so that it turns on and off whatever's plugged into it at a certain time of day or night. And in my home at 10 p.m. every weekday, my internet router shuts off.
Hardcore. Wow.
So why did I do that? What I did was that I made the action phase of the hook a little bit more difficult. I could still go and unplug it and plug my router back in, right?
Or go on your cell phone, yeah.
Right, right. I could do that. But the point is, breaking the hook allows you to have a moment of mindfulness as opposed to mindlessly using these products. So that's an example of how you can make the action a bit more difficult. The trigger, that's an easy one. Don't sleep with devices in your bedroom, right? Like, don't have your cell phone next to your bed. That's a terrible trigger for you to overuse some of these technologies. Always charge your devices outside of your bedroom. Variable reward, this is a great example. So what I do is, one bad habit I always had was that I would read an article online. And then, of course, you know, these media sites are built to keep you on their pages. So, of course, on the right-hand side, they will show you other stories, right, with great headlines, clickbaity headlines to get you to keep looking at more and more articles. So I have a rule that I never read articles on my desktop. And what I do instead is I use this app called Pocket, which strips away all the ads and just gives you the text of the article you want to read. And it puts it on your mobile phone in this little app. And then here's the behavioral design 2.0, right? The upgrade is, I use a technique called temptation bundling. So what I do is, temptation bundling is when you take a reward that you want and you use it to do something you kind of don't want to do. And my kind of don't want to do behavior is going to the gym.
Right.
So I only allow myself to digest these articles when I'm in the gym. But then you say, well, how do you read articles while you're lifting weights? Well, I use a different app called Voice Dream that will read, you know, like a Siri voice will read my articles to me. And that's kind of my reward.
Wow. So it'll read them straight out of Pocket?
Straight out. Well, you have to. Yeah, it has an API. Exactly. Imports them from Pocket.
I do something similar with a few of the podcasts that I listen to, where I set a rule that I only listen to these when I'm at the gym. And
exactly.
It gets me to go.
Yeah. So what I've done, I still have the variable reward, because the variable reward, of course, is built into the content. I want to know what's behind those clickbaity headlines. I want to know the answer to the mystery. But I can just listen to those variable rewards in the gym. And then the investment part is that I just set some clear rules about what I won't invest in. So I don't start any experiences without a finite end. Meaning, and I know some of your listeners are going to hate this advice, I don't watch any serialized shows.
Oh, wow.
And I don't play any games you can't beat, right? So, like, I won't start an experience unless it has a finite end. Movies, I love, because I know how long I'm going to sit in that seat and watch a movie. But I won't watch, like, a Game of Thrones because it just goes on and on and on. And I know that the designers of those experiences have built them with these cliffhangers to keep you watching and watching and watching forever and ever.
So would you watch, like, a show that you knew was over in 8 seasons?
If you know, I might if it was like a show that was over, like Breaking Bad or something, that they're not making any more of them.
Yeah,
because then I know the investment, and then I can decide, hey, is putting in time to that experience consistent with my values and what I think is worth putting time into, or is it something that's going to suck me in and then I'm going to regret it later?
You should totally watch Breaking Bad, by the way.
You know, the last serialized show I saw was 24 with Kiefer Sutherland back in the day.
Oh yeah.
And after that, I said no more. I can't do this.
That was what broke you.
Yes. Yes. So I don't know anything about Game of Thrones. I don't know anything about House of Cards, because I know the way they're designed.
Well, we pick our virtues and our vices, I guess.
Right. Right. And by the way, this isn't a judgment call. I think one thing that's really interesting when you study engaging products is that people tend to think that their thing is perfectly cool and wonderful, but of course somebody else's thing is ridiculous. So, you know, I watch sports every day and spend hours, you know, catching up on ESPN, but oh my God, that Pokemon Go thing, how frivolous, right?
Right.
And that's silly.
Yeah, I always get that feeling from people that don't understand watching like streamers or YouTubers doing Let's Plays or people streaming playing video games, who will sit there and watch other people play sports for hours on end, but they
right.
completely escapes them how it could be worthwhile to watch somebody else play a game.
Exactly. And that gets into the whole self-identity stuff and value stuff. That's a whole nother psychology to it.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So lots of good information, and sounds like some tricky sort of psychological judo to take the hook model and make it work for you in breaking habits as well as making them.
Absolutely.
So, let me just ask a couple of questions before we wrap up. Have you been playing anything lately? Have you played any games, mobile or otherwise?
So my game, so to speak, lately has been Snapchat, and I had to actually like dial it back. I think Snapchat is such a well-designed hook that...
Now, what is Snapchat for anybody that might not know? Although I can't imagine there would be anyone.
Yeah, who doesn't know anymore? But Snapchat is doing incredibly well. It's, you know, it's primarily a camera-first experience. So unlike, you know, Instagram or other photo sharing services that are really social networks first, where they have a feed, you'll notice that with Snapchat, I think they built it in a really smart way where the habit they want you to build is to snap, is to take a quick picture. So even the landing screen is the camera screen, which is very telling about how they've designed that product. And so the first habit is around snapping stuff and sharing it with people who follow you. And they've stripped out a lot of the mechanics of other apps. They've stripped out to really make it as easy as possible just to share a picture. But then you start consuming content as well. And of course, you know that the trick with Snapchat is that in 24 hours, those other people's snaps will disappear. So if you don't watch it, right, they use loss aversion. So that if you don't watch somebody else's snap, it's going to be gone.
Oh.
So for the ones who make great content, you really want to see what they're posting. So,
it's not just it disappears after you look at it. It disappears after 24
hours,
whether you've looked at it or not.
Right, right. So once you start watching content on Snapchat, they really suck you in. And there's some people, you know, it used to be really kind of stuff that wasn't that interesting to me. It was more silliness. But then, you know, a few prominent venture capitalists started getting on there. A few prominent entrepreneurs started getting on there in the tech industry, and they were making great content, and I didn't want to miss that content. And so that's how it got me sucked in.
Cool. All right. So if people wanted to go online and find out more about you and some of the research you've done and maybe check out your book, where would be the best place for them to go?
Sure. So the book is called Hooked: How to Build Habit-Forming Products, and it's available, you know, anywhere books are sold. And my blog is nearandfar.com, and near is spelled like my first name, nirandfar.com.
Okay, awesome. Well, thanks so much for coming on. I feel like we could keep talking forever and ever, but I don't want to keep you too long, and certainly giving me a lot to think about.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
All right, everybody. I hope you enjoyed that interview and this episode of the podcast. If you have any insights or experiences about habit-forming games or how you broke habits with games that you would have rather not have, let me know. You can find the blog entry for this episode on psychologyofgames.com, and you can find other information like how to support me on my Patreon campaign and how to follow me on Twitter, Facebook, etc., and how to subscribe to the podcast if you haven't done so already. Thanks, and I'll talk to you next episode.